This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll check in on a Greenpeace activist with Connecticut roots who is arrested by Russian officials on charges of piracy. And we'll hear from Herb Kanin, the diplomatic correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. But first, photographer Chris Capozzella has been photographing his twin brother Nick for years. Despite there being twins, there was a major difference between these two. Nick was born with cerebral palsy, and Chris was not. The photography of both brothers is featured in the new book, The Distance Between Us, which is being released later this month. Chris's photos show the tough, painful scenes of seizure-like cramps taking a hold of Nick. But they also show some happier, pain-free times, including scenes from a cross-country road trip that the brothers took together. If you'd like to see some of these photos, you can go to our website, WNPR.org, for a preview of what's in the book. Both brothers stopped by our studios to talk about their project. Chris and Nick Capozzella, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
First of all, Chris, why don't you tell us why you embarked on this project, this book, The Distance Between Us?
Well, this is definitely a different sort of story. It's not something I ever set out to do and said, I'm going to photograph my brother. I want to examine this. I started making pictures 13 years ago now when I was a student. And you know, we had professors up at RIT who encouraged us to look at things that are around us, things that we're used to. And so when I would go home on breaks, I would photograph Nick. And so in the beginning, it was a way of practicing. It was a way of, you know, me trying to figure out who I was becoming as a photographer. And so the early pictures were that. It was sort of an exercise in seeing. And as the years went on, I continued to make pictures of Nick. And I would make pictures of us hanging out at family picnics, going out to a bar and having a drink, out front of our house, you know, throwing a tennis ball around. There's actually a picture in the book of I always have my camera over my shoulder, and so we're out front throwing this tennis ball around, and Nick didn't catch it, and he had to run down the street, and there's this photograph of him running towards a car. It looks like the car's gonna hit him. And so, I think that, you know, sometimes pictures mean something different to different people. We have Nick and I and my family have deeper insight, but then someone sees that photograph of Nick being, you know, confronted by this car, and it means something different to them. And, you know, and there's a danger, I think, in photography in that pictures can lie. And so we edit with that in mind. I said before, as like the years went on, I continued to photograph, and I didn't really know why I kept photographing Nick, because as much as I was photographing the happy times, the times when he wasn't in pain, I was also photographing him in pain. And in the middle of it, I couldn't tell you why I was making those pictures, you know, and I'm working as a freelance photojournalist, you know, having to understand why I'm looking at specific things on a daily basis. And then in my other long-form projects that I'm not commissioned to do, but things that I care about looking at and asking questions about, you know. But with my own family and my own brother, you know, I didn't know why I was taking pictures of him with a cramp. And so, you know, Nick is sitting here with us right now, and he's fine, you know. But sometimes a cramp will come on, and it's like this transformation of he's able to talk right now, and then slowly he's unable to talk, and his body will lock and contort, and he can't move. And so, you know, I made pictures of Nick during those times, and I didn't know why when I was younger. It was a long process of me answering why I was doing this, and then about 3 years ago, looking at this really this growing archive of photographs of him, and having to answer to myself, well, why do I have these pictures? Should I share this at all? And that was a long process to come to, because, you know, Nick and I are so much alike, but we're also very different. And there's always an element of pity, and I always had a really hard time dealing with that growing up. The pictures, in a strange way, forced me to deal with these things. And it wasn't anything that was, you know, thought out beforehand. It just turned out to be that way.
Well Nick, I'll ask you, how was it to have your brother first starting to photograph you just as something he was doing to learn his craft, and then more and more as a document of your life and your life together? I mean, how did it feel to have him always there with a camera capturing you when you were good and when you were in pain?
Okay, well, at first, like, I was like, oh, another picture? Jeez, you know, put the camera away.
In the beginning, Nick didn't always like it that I would take pictures, and And so sometimes you would turn his head. Or, you know, I have pictures of him with – he's covering his face with a pillow or in the living room. And one day, I think I was still a student in undergrad, and I walked into our bedroom. Now, we had bunk beds. And I would, you know, I had the top bunk, though, all right? You know, that's better. So I walk in, though, and Nick was sleeping in bed, and he was waking up from a cramp, and the light was just beautiful, and the windows were open, and I came in, and I, you know, as a young photographer, I look at this, and I go, wow, look at this light. And so I bend down with my old Nikon camera, and I take a picture, but the shutter was really loud on those old cameras, and it sort of startled him. And you remember what you did?
I think I hit him in the balls.
Well, no, I was crouched down. You hit me in the face. So I'm sitting there holding my face. Dad hears the camera hit the floor, and you know, runs into the bedroom, and you know, says, "Why? You know, he doesn't like when you take pictures of him when he's sleeping. You know, why did you do that?" And you know, naively, I said, "Dad, look at the light. It's beautiful." And you know, Dad sort of grumbles when he walks out and says, you know, something how I don't always listen, you know. So that was pretty indicative of how Nick felt about the pictures in the beginning, right?
But did it change over time? I mean, did you get more comfortable with him always taking your picture?
I think it was not me getting more comfortable, but it was like more of me just getting used to it, and I was like, why sweat the small stuff? Now that I'm more used to it, it really doesn't bother me.
One of the things that I think is interesting about the book is that it seems as though, and you talk about editing the many, many, many pictures that you took, Chris, it seems as though that there's a really interesting mix of photos that show Nick in pain, in a cramp, in the hospital, and other photos where if you didn't know his story and you didn't know his condition, he would look like, frankly, anybody else on the street. And I'm wondering if you can talk about those choices that you made about that.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, with any story that any of us as journalists work on, you know, we want it to be honest. And so for me, you know, it's been a sort of long journey to see past our differences, you know, because it hurt. It made me feel guilty. And that was something that, like, I mean, we've just recently started talking about that. I mean, I've been sharing this story for a few years, but I never told Nick or my parents that I felt guilty. I've wondered if somehow I caused this for him, if I did something in the womb that caused him to not breathe, and that's what happened. And cerebral palsy, you know, in Nick's situation, is an accident of birth. And so I, for a long time, had a hard time looking past, you know, the pain that he was experiencing every day. But I knew that with the pictures that, and with telling his story, you know, he is more than just his disability. And so, you know, I want to be fair with my brother, like I try to be fair with every other story that I work on, and hit different notes of his life, you know, and showing parts of his life that include pain, and then also show parts of his life that include, you know, who he is as a human being, his humor, that extends beyond the pictures and into the text. You know, I'm stuck in a visual world because I'm a photographer and it's my chosen craft. But I think that text is something beautiful and can add so much, you know, to any story. And so, you know, there's a picture of him dancing with this really beautiful woman. At a bar in San Juan Capistrano. We were out there a few years ago with some friends, and he's like eyeing this woman all night, you know, the prettiest woman in the bar. And our friend's sister, you know, asks her, you know, would you mind dancing with my friend? And you can tell, you know, we're standing, you know, across the bar, and you can read her body language. She thinks this is sort of strange. And she says no, but then a few minutes later she agrees. And Nick's dancing with her. And so I don't want it to be an awkward moment, but I make some pictures, you know. I think we have to remember this, you know. And afterwards, he walks over and he said, "She kept telling me not to look at her feet, but I wasn't looking at her feet." And it's so like, you know, I think that you know, when we look at people who have disabilities who struggle, many of us, you know, we get stuck in this sadness for them that they have a life that's different than ours, and I feel this way often. I feel bad for them. I feel terrible. I feel like this isn't how it's supposed to be for them. You know, and they may feel completely different, you know. People with disabilities oftentimes see themselves different than we do. And so I want to make sure that I'm not just using this as an exercise to say, I feel guilty, I feel terrible that this is how it is, but to include those things in order to be honest, but then also balance it with, well, as hard as things might be for Nick, like, he's actually a really funny guy, and he has these awesome, you know, things happen to him with really pretty women at bars, you know, who dance with him. They won't dance with me. They'll dance with him, right? And I think that in the end, like, we have something to gain from that. If we're just too heavy-handed with one aspect of any story, you know, I think that, you know, we fall short, and it's not always honest to do that.
Nick, can you talk about that a little bit? I you want to pick up on that?
Yeah. There's this one time when I was at Orange Ale House, and I was actually singing a Tim McGraw song, and I knew Chris was taking pictures, and like I basically know all the words, and when it came time to say something like that, I, you know, turned my head and I was saying, you know, something like that, and I was nodding and smiling, and I thought I turned and smiled at him, but it was this like blind hourglass figure girl, and her name was Michelle. I was wearing my cowboy hat, and she came up to me and said, I like your hat. And then she says, now where are your boots? So I told her, I left them at home.
Dude, you're forgetting something major here. She walked up to him and grabbed a hold of his hands and said this to him. I mean, squared off with him and just like, I like your hat, but where are your boots? And
I said to her that I'll wear them, the next time I come down. And so she says, okay. And then the next time I went, she wasn't there. And the whole time we were talking, I could see Chris off in the distance, but I was like saying, take a picture, take a picture, take a picture. But he didn't take a picture.
You didn't take a picture of that one.
I didn't. I was standing pretty close to them, and because it was a conversation, and I didn't want her to feel like a spectacle, I didn't want to ruin the moment, you know. That time I didn't, and so it's one of those pictures that I didn't take that I'll always remember, you know.
When we come back from our break, we'll continue our conversation with Chris and Nick Capozzello. You can see some photos from The Distance Between Us on our website, WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. You had a suntan line and red lipstick. I worked so hard for that first kiss. And I'm hard, don't forget something like that. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're listening back to a conversation I recently had with twin brothers Chris and Nick Capozzello. Nick has cerebral palsy, and in Chris's latest book, The Distance Between Us, he chronicles his brother's life and deals with some of his own grief. Now, you can see some of the photographs that we're talking about on our website right now. It's WNPR.org. One of the stories you tell, you mentioned earlier this idea of guilt that you have as a twin without this disability. You write a very powerful passage about an encounter you had at a bar in New Haven, and you talk afterward about shame And I'm wondering if you can just tell that story briefly for us and talk about what you mean when you talk about being ashamed. Because I think it's a really important part of the story that you're telling here.
Yeah. So the story in that text was that Nick and I were in New Haven with some friends at a masquerade ball. And so we're in New Haven, and Yale's in session, and it's a Friday night, right? It was a Friday night.
A Friday or Saturday.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And we're walking down the street, and, you know, whenever we're walking in public, generally, Nick, you sort of lag behind, right? And so
yeah.
I always look over my shoulder. He walks slower than us, and so I'm with my roommate at the time.
And I also have, like, a weird kind of stagger to myself.
Yeah. And so I turn around to make, you know, see where Nick is, and there's this group of kids outside a pizza joint next to this bar. And when I turn around, I see this one kid who's mimicking the way Nick walks. He's walking right behind him, and he's sort of like rocking his head back and forth the way Nick does when he walks. I mean, it's like Nick said, his walk is sort of staggered, and you know, in that moment, I mean, something in me snapped, and I feel protective of my brother. And you're looking at me. I'm not a tough guy, you know, but something, you know, I've always felt protective over Nick, and I know that. You know, Nick feels the same way about me. He wouldn't want anybody to make fun or hurt me, or, you know, even some of the comments that have come out about this story, Nick has taken some offense to it, you know. At that moment, you know, something snaps, and I get into it with these kids. And I, as soon as I walk over to them, like, I'm surrounded, and the kid that was making fun of Nick is on the outside of this, you know, this crowd, you know, And I don't really remember all that I was saying, but I remember saying something along the lines of, like, would any of you allow someone else to make fun of your crippled brother? And Nick sort of takes offense to cripple because he's not really cripple. But I remember using that word in anger to illustrate to them. And in the middle of that, like, you know, it's a strange thing. You know, anytime you're in sort of a situation where tension is very high, where your head goes, and I remember in that moment, you know, realizing that, like, it's not this kid that I'm really angry at. It's, like, the guilt and the shame that I've carried my whole life. And I think that, you know, it's scary to, you know, I'm sitting next to Nick saying this, and I've read the book and we've talked about this, but the first time I read that to him and to my family, I was scared. You know, how are they going to take that? Because I'm not ashamed of my brother. You know, I'm ashamed of standing next to him, being the healthy twin, the able-bodied twin, you know, and being the example of what life could have been like for him. And that is hard because as life changes for me, life doesn't change as quickly for Nick. And that's been a hard thing to deal with. And it's something that I didn't want to always talk about. I talk about it with my friends. Those that were close to me, I talk about it with. It's not that I've been denying these things over the years, but to share that, you know, with the journalism community and the community that I work within. Now that means I'm sitting here talking to you about it, and then people are going to listen to this, right? And then I put it in a book and people are going to read that. And some may take offense to that, and I don't want to offend anybody who's, you know, who deals with disability. But the shame was over, you know, the shame I felt was because I live a better life than he does, and I have choices that he doesn't have. And standing next to him, you know, I am that example. The guilt is over having those choices. The guilt is over the fact that I can sling my camera over my shoulder, hop in my car and go anywhere, and Nick can't drive. And he has different things available to him than I do.
Actually, I want to add on to what he said about not being able to drive. That is wrong. I can drive. It's just I chose not to because in case I'm driving and I'm on the road and I have a cramp, I don't want to hurt anybody or at the worst kill anybody. So that's why I decided it'll probably be better if I don't drive.
If I just cut for one second, I just want to say that about that, and that was his choice. And that's that for me is a beautiful thing that Nick made that choice when we were kids, you know, we were teenagers, and he's continued to make that choice, you know, that he won't put himself in that situation, not wanting to hurt anybody else. And that, I mean, it's beautiful that he chooses that.
Yeah. Kind of wish I could, but I really don't like relying on other people to drive me around here and there.
Do you feel happy having seen the book? Do you feel like the book is an accurate representation of your life in some way?
Yeah. I really don't like seeing myself in the situations when I have the cramps, and especially the ones when I'm lying on the floor and those seizure-like cramps. Main thing is, like, I do like the pictures, like, when I'm obviously not having a cramp, like when he talked about before about me running down the street to catch the ball, and the car's coming. It looks like I'm going for a death wish. He's got another picture. I think it's me lying down on my bed with a hamster.
Yes, it's a beautiful picture.
Yeah, I don't have that one anymore, but I always take them out, like, all the time, and I play with them all every night. So, because they're nocturnal, so got to take them out at night. Yeah, you know, I don't want to wake them up to play with them. But
I actually had noted that it's a beautiful, beautiful picture, and you can sort of and you can tell the love that went into it too, into actually taking that exposure of that moment.
Yeah, I mean that, you know, that picture. I made that right before I moved to Mississippi for. It was the second time I moved down there. And, you know, when I made that, I remember, you know, and it's the difference between, like, his perception versus mine, you know, whereas he loves that picture. It made me feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've felt like for a long time that, like, he's always stuck in that room of ours that we grew up in. And when I made that picture, I left the next day for Mississippi feeling like, well, that's what I'm leaving him with, is his hamsters, you know. And it's a tender moment for sure. But I have, like, initially I had different feelings about it, you know? And so for me, the beginning part of the book, you know, was really, really heavy on, like, my grief and my laments over things being different, you know? And so when when you ask, you know, Nick, do you think that this is an accurate, you know, presentation of what your life is like? You know, for a long time, as I was working through these edits early on, it really wasn't, you know, because it was heavy on my grief, you know. And it wasn't until the last few years that, you know, slowly I started to move past that. And it, you know, when the beginning of the book starts off with, I want answers, you know, mm-hmm. which is, you know, you see someone you love suffer. And most of us, you know, the initial response is, God, why did this happen? You know, why did this horrible thing happen to this wonderful person, right? And so,
you think I'm wonderful?
You know, you're pretty. You're stellar, man. But, like, you know, throughout the whole process, and I, you know, I don't want to say, well, like the pictures, you know, did this for me. It made me work on this. In some ways, they did, right? But you know, through the whole process, I started to move past that question. Well, why does this happen to Nick? Why does it happen to anybody? And the questions about, you know, faith and things like that. To, like, asking healthier questions, you know, and I think that coming out on the other side, I think as a whole, I hope as a whole that it's more accurate. I mean, if you saw the, like, part two and three, I mean, the tone is totally different, you know, and for me, you know, last year when we took that road trip, you know, I mean, I needed that, and I didn't realize how much I needed it at the time, but it was just us out there on the road, like, being brothers and goofing off. you know, running around making pictures, and it was, and that came after our papa, our grandfather, had passed away. He'd been at that point, he'd been gone for about a year and a half, and he'd said, you know, you need to make sure that you take care of Nick when mom and dad can't anymore. And that's also, like, to even look Nick in the eye right now and like, say it again after having read it to him and talked about it, it's hard because, Nick, you know, you're not incapable, you know. But I know that if I was sick, you would do the same thing for me. And so...
Yeah, sure.
You know, yeah. And so it's, you know, even for me, like, that was a scary thing to admit. But on the other side of that those hard things came this, okay, well, you know, if there's an answer as to why Nick has cerebral palsy, I don't actually want to know it. If there's some sort of cosmic answer and, you know, and I found out, well, this is the reason why Nick has suffered and has a harder life than I do, it wouldn't make any sense to me. It wouldn't make me feel any better. And so part two and three of the book is me moving past those questions that I think are very human questions, and it's understandable to have those questions, but they're not helpful and they're not going to lead you anywhere good. And so, well, what is next for us, I think, is now on the other side of it seems very simple, but it took me a long time to get there, right?
It's funny. The more I talk to you, Chris, this book's really about you, isn't it? I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a lot about a lot of the things that you've been dealing with, too. It's very interesting because, you know, often people think of photography books as books about the subject of those photographs. And this is really something that it seems really helped you get through something. This is a story about your life, too.
Yeah, it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, as the title says, the difference between us.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Is, yeah.
Come on, John, it's always been about us.
but there's parts of it that are basically telling about, you know, just my experience, and then about other parts are telling about how Chris has to deal with it, and I think that is a really good a really good way that that actually kind of like brought us closer together. I mean, like when we were on the road trip, like for three weeks, we did a lot of stuff together, and we went to like a lot of places that we both have never been before. And just to share that experience with each other is something that I will never forget, and I know he won't forget either. And of course, we went to a few other places that we've been to before, but those two were very cherishable memories, and I was taking pictures with my iPod, and like when I would take pictures, I'm glad I was taking pictures with my iPod, but it was something that I think I had to do, because if I didn't, like when I'm old and grayer, I want to look back at these pictures and just be able to remember the good times that we had.
Well, Nick, your photos, and Chris, your photos, part of this book, The Distance Between Us. Thank you both so much for joining me. I really, really appreciate it. It was great to meet you.
It was good meeting you, too.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, two international stories that we're following. Herb Kanan of the Jerusalem Post updates us on peace talks in the Middle East. And a Connecticut man's being held in a Russian prison after being charged with piracy during a Greenpeace protest. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, it's town ranking time again, and Connecticut Magazine is doing things a bit differently this time around. Instead of grouping towns by population, they're now looking at average home value. We'll dive into what these new rankings say and where you might look to find a real estate deal. And according to a new report by the Partnership for Strong Communities, there still isn't enough affordable housing in Connecticut. Join us for that conversation on Monday's Where We Live. Now, a few weeks back, we had conversation with peace activists who've been on both sides of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Today, conversation with a reporter who views the world through what he calls the Israeli perspective. Herb Kanan has been a reporter for the Jerusalem Post for the last 25 years. He travels extensively to cover Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and was in Connecticut this week for a series of speaking engagements sponsored by the Jewish Federation Association of Connecticut. I asked him first to give us an update on the ongoing peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians being led by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
Look, right now, we're in the middle. I mean, these things started at the beginning of August, the end of July. They have a 9-month timeline on them, or I think Secretary of State Kerry said that he believes that within 9 months it's able to get a deal. And we're very much in the middle. Unlike previous stabs at this, and there's been a lot of them, this thing is being done very much in quiet. Kerry kind of put a gag order on it, saying, I'm the only guy who's going to talk about what's happening behind closed doors. Only trust what I say. Don't trust what anybody else says. Don't trust what you read in the paper. I'm the guy who's speaking. So we have kind of an anomalous situation where you have talks going on, and they've been happening pretty intensively a couple of times a week in Jerusalem. And nobody really knows what's going on, right? I mean, beyond knowing that they're meeting and certain leaks that are coming out primarily in the Arab media, we don't really know where it's going.
So not knowing where it's going, is that better or worse?
Look, I think that overall the idea, Kerry's idea in keeping these things very quiet is if the media is involved, if it becomes a media circus, then the negotiators, instead of dealing with the nuts and bolts issues on the table, are going to be playing to their own domestic publics through the media. And I think we've seen this in the past, and I think it's true. Right. If the media is there, if the media knows where the meetings are going to be and they're going to be there afterward with the microphones, it adds a certain dynamic to the negotiations, which makes it a bit more difficult because each side will play to the domestic audience. If the media is kept outside of it, they can talk very honestly inside the room without worrying that this stuff is going to be leaked out. And I think that's a positive element of it. However, I think that there's a flip side, or I don't know if it's not exactly the same, but at a certain extent, if it's serious, if there's serious things on the table, if mm-hmm. they're talking about borders, if they're talking about Jerusalem, if you're talking about major concessions that both Israel and the Palestinians are going to have to make, at a certain point in time, you're going to have to include the people as well, because they're going to have to be the ones who agree with it, right? I mean, this thing will live and die whether or not the governments feel that the people support it. So at a certain point in time, you have to let the cat out of the bag. And apparently we're not at that time yet because, again, beyond knowing that they're talking about the core issues, we don't know a lot else what's going on behind closed doors.
Given what you've said about this being done behind closed doors, what do you make of the fact that at the UN recently, Mahmoud Abbas talked about this 9-month time frame and pushed for this fairly condensed time frame for talks that you mentioned Secretary Kerry pushing, but that Benjamin Netanyahu, when given a chance to speak to the world, talked about Iran, didn't talk about these talks at all, didn't talk about the Israel-Palestinian issue. I guess, first of all, what did you make of those statements coming out of the UN, and why do you think that this is something that Netanyahu did not take to the UN?
I think that Netanyahu spoke for 33 minutes, and 30 of those minutes were devoted to Iran, 3 minutes devoted to the Palestinians, not necessarily because he doesn't think the Palestinians are important or because this is an important issue. But I think what this does is kind of give a pretty good signal to the world what is the prime focus for Netanyahu, for his government, I think for Israel. And I think it's fair to say that the prime focus right now is Iran. I mean, the Palestinians is an important issue. Terrorism is something that is very difficult for Israel, but it's not an existential threat. Okay, it's not. I mean, Israel can survive the terrorism. We've shown that in the past. It's not an existential threat. Iran, a country that has openly expressed that it wants Israel to disappear. It's got a radical ideology. If it gets the potential, the capabilities to obliterate the country, that is an existential threat for Israel. And I think what you saw at the UN was very clearly this is Netanyahu's agenda. The first issue is Iran. The second issue is Iran. The third issue is Iran, and then it's everything else.
Mm. So, given this, of course, from the outside, without this laser focus that Israeli leadership would have on Iran, the rest of the world looks at this issue and says, "Well, Iran has some new leadership who seems to be saying different things than they have in the past." The United States and the rest of the world seems to, at least, say that they're thinking about softening their stance as far as sanctions, softening their stance as far as what they expect from Iran. I guess I'm wondering from where you sit, give me your thoughts on this, the world perspective on Iran and its new leadership and where it's headed with its nuclear program versus what the people of Israel are thinking about it.
Look, I think the Israeli perspective as reflected through the government is as follows. Iran's been trying to get a nuclear weapon for 30 years, right? It hasn't gotten there, not because they're not a capable, smart, efficient people, as capable, smart, as efficient as Israelis, the Indians, or the Pakistanis are. They haven't gotten there because things have happened on the ground over this time period to keep them from getting there. And what's happened? Computer worms have happened. The assassination of scientists has happened from the West, right? Straw companies were set up in the world selling bad material to the Iranians. So when they spin the centrifuges, it blows up in the faces. And the whole idea behind this was to kick the can down the road, to buy time, hoping that in the interim something will happen inside Iran to get the people to push the government to say, you know what? This isn't a good idea. It's not worth it. It's not worth the price. It's not worth the price of our destroying the economy or damaging the country by going for the nuclear weapons. Let's give it up. That's been the whole strategy up until now. You finally have a situation that happened in 2012 when the world put down extremely tough sanctions on Iran, which got him to move. How do we know it got him to move? The fact that Rouhani, the new president, was elected. Right? He's a moderate. The people wanted a moderate because they want to try a different approach because the old approach wasn't working. So what's Israel saying? Israel's not saying don't negotiate. Israel's not saying don't talk. Israel's saying talk, but keep the heat up until they take material steps on the ground to dismantle the program.
But is there a fear amongst any, though, that by approaching this new leader who is a moderate or more moderate, by approaching him as though he's part of the same Iranian dictatorship that has been in place for decades, that indeed you're not taking an opportunity to actually say there is something that has changed. We maybe have affected change in Iran. Let's deal with this new guy as though there's actually something new happening here.
Look, I think there's a basic misperception, and that is that there's a new guy. I mean, the new guy is the old guy. It's the supreme leader Khamenei. He's the guy who's calling the shots. The president is the front man. So you have a new front man out there because the supreme leader realizes that the old approach wasn't working. Let's do something different. But it's the same leader. It's the same leader. The man calling the shots is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. And it's not Rouhani. Rouhani is the face. Rouhani is the facade. But he's not the guy making the decisions. That has not changed.
And Herb Kanin joins us here on Where We Live. I guess I'm wondering if we can get back briefly to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. We recently had a program in which we brought in some people who were working across borders to achieve some sort of peace between Israelis and Palestinians. And they talk about, and I asked them about the two-state solution, as we call it, the idea of a Palestinian state and Israeli state existing side by side. What does the idea of a two-state solution mean to you, Herb?
Look, I think the idea of a two-state solution means that the Palestinians have a state that they can call their national home and that the Palestinians who want to go live in Palestine will go live in the Palestinian national home. And the Jews have a state of their own, which is a Jewish national home and which is recognized by the Arabs and the Palestinians is the place, the sovereign place for the Jews to have a state. I think that's a two-state solution. I think also I think it's for me, a Palestinian state doesn't necessarily mean a state that has all the trappings that every other country in the world right now has, meaning a full military or full control of the borders, because I have to worry about my own security. And my concern is if I leave the territories, right, without foolproof security things in place, then this territory will become a stepping ground in which to attack me. And it's not like I'm making this up out of thin air. I mean, Israel has left Lebanon in 2000. And the minute it left Lebanon, Hezbollah walked in. Iranian-backed Hezbollah walked in. And they have now 50 to 60,000 rockets arrayed in southern Lebanon ready to fire upon our homes.
But what are the borders around which that Palestinian territory would be? Are we talking about Gaza and a portion of the West Bank? Are we talking about a Palestinian state that is bifurcated? What are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, that's a big question. What are we talking about? I mean, the Palestinian, you talk about the Palestinians, and you have two different separate Palestinian entities right now, which aren't exactly talking to each other, right, which don't exactly get along. What happens? How does Abu Mazen, how does Fatah in the West Bank, how do they regain control of Hamas in Gaza? I'm not sure. I'm not sure anybody knows the answer to that. So that's also something that has to be worked out within this whole, you know, talk about a two-state solution.
Herb Kanin, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Herb Kanin is a diplomatic correspondent for The Jerusalem Post. If you're interested in Middle East issues and the Palestinian-Israeli peace process, there are a series of upcoming events that you should know about. Now, on October 22nd, Hartford Seminary is hosting a conversation about legal traditions in the Jewish and Muslim faiths. The next day, the World Affairs Council of Connecticut begins a two-part series called Israel and Palestine, Is It Now or Never? For more information on these programs or to hear our recent show with Combatants for Peace, go to WNPR.org. When NSA leaker Edward Snowden was given asylum in Russia, it marked another rough patch in U.S. relations with that country. Another story's gone a bit under the radar, though, and that's the story of Greenpeace activists arrested in September by Russian officials who stormed their boat. The activists were protesting oil drilling in the Arctic. The captain of the boat has been involved in other high-profile Greenpeace protests in the past, and he's from Norwalk, Connecticut. Here to talk with us is David Hench, staff writer for the Portland Press-Herald, who's been following this story. David, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
What exactly was this Greenpeace ship, the Arctic Sunrise, doing off the waters of Russia?
Well, as I understand it, they're very committed to protecting the Arctic ocean environment, and they had decided to go stage a protest up there, planned extensively for heading up there, and I think we're just hoping to make a statement, and we're a little surprised by the response of the security forces and the Russian equivalent of the Coast Guard when they got there.
The Russian equivalent of the Coast Guard storms the ship and essentially takes these folks prisoner. They are activists, people who are journalists working on this protest against oil drilling in the Arctic. All of them are still being held in Russia right now. What do we know about their whereabouts, and how long are they going to be there?
Well, from what I understand, we don't know how long they're going to be there. They've been charged with an extremely serious crime of piracy, which carries a very heavy sentence, I believe, of upwards around 15 years. At the moment, they haven't been tried. They're being held in various locations around Murmansk, and basically very difficult. Nobody been able, for the most part, to communicate with them, although I guess they have had some legal counsel that's been able to talk to them.
So you got to talk with Maggie Wilcox, who is the wife of the captain of this ship. Peter Wilcox is someone who grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut, but Maggie lives in Maine. So what did she tell you?
Well, it's really a fascinating story, as so often is the case, beyond the activism of the Greenpeace workers, is this family story. She and Peter Wilcox had worked together on a boat called the Clearwater back many, many, many years ago, involved in protests trying to get the Hudson River cleaned up. They went their separate ways, each had families, and then reconnected several months ago, and they'd each since become single. They found they still had a great affection for each other. Maggie really respects the work that Peter does, and so they got married in the beautiful, idyllic setting of Islesboro, Maine.
That's quite an amazing story. And that boat that you're talking about, the Clearwater, is a boat that's well known to a lot of our listeners. Pete Seeger, the famous musician, in his attempt to clean up the Hudson, which has been polluted for years with PCBs from General Electric, still an ongoing effort to clean that up since the 1970s. That was the same boat that Pete Seeger used, right?
Exactly right, and it's got a pretty, I think, storied place in environmental activism, and I think one of the reasons I thought it was important to mention it was because, in many respects, I think they had great success. I mean, it used to be the Hudson River, and nobody wanted to be anywhere near it, and quite honestly, while this was going on, a neighbor of mine was taking a cruise up the Hudson River, a scenic, lovely cruise up this beautiful waterway. So I thought it was somewhat apropos.
Now, for people who've never heard of Peter Wilcox before, he's been involved in other high-profile activist campaigns by Greenpeace in the past, not just aboard the Clearwater, but if you remember the Rainbow Warrior, this was the ship back in 1985 that was actually bombed. What can you tell us about his involvement there?
Well, again, just based on my research for the story, he was the captain, and he's really been a dedicated Greenpeace activist to his career. He feels very committed about the environment. They were protesting nuclear testing in the South Pacific. We're in a peaceful harbor of New Zealand, and apparently was on board when explosions ripped through the ship. He managed to get himself to safety, but sadly there was a Portuguese photographer who did not and died in the assault. And actually, at the moment, they didn't know what had happened, but I think the New Zealand authorities were actually able to detain a couple of French agents as they were trying to leave the country after that explosion.
We're talking with David Hench, who's a staff writer for the Portland Press Herald, who's been following the story of Greenpeace activists who've been jailed in Russia on charges of piracy, and they're still being held in Russia. He spoke with Maggie Wilcox, who lives in Maine. Maggie Wilcox is the wife of Peter Wilcox, who is a Connecticut native, who is the captain of this ship and has been the captain of several Greenpeace ships on a series of activist campaigns over the years. So what was Maggie Wilcox able to tell you about Peter? Has she heard from him at all? Does she know his whereabouts or how he's doing?
Well, she really hadn't been able to communicate with him at all. Her last communication was a copy of an email that he was actually sending to Greenpeace that he was kind enough to CC his wife on that mentioned that they were storming the ship and nobody had been hurt, but that the Russians were taking over his ship. And after that, it was basically just trying to follow media coverage until that got to be too painful for her. And then she basically has been kept informed primarily by Greenpeace, although I gather there's some Foreign Service folks in Russia that have been able to communicate with her.
In your story, she actually says that she saw some pictures of him behind bars, including a picture that I've seen, too, of him being led down the hall, shackled, escorted by Russians on either side. And she says he had this wicked grin on his face. Did that signal something to his wife back home?
Well, I think so. I mean, one of the things that's, he's obviously a leader in his efforts here. And I think there's a great deal of uncertainty among the people who care for him. But when you see that kind of expression and you realize that, this is a guy who knows what he's doing, obviously a big part of what Greenpeace was trying to achieve there was to draw attention to the potential threats as they saw it to the Arctic. So I think he felt pretty comfortable in his surroundings, even if he wishes he was back in Connecticut.
someplace else. Well, David Hench, thank you so much, and we'll be checking back for an update on this, and hopefully these folks will be able to be returned to the United States and the UK and the various places where they come from just as soon as possible. Thanks again for your time.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan. The senior producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.